It's now time to begin with our next pioneer, and the one we're going to be looking at now is number 21 on our 27 pioneer timeline chart, J.N. Loughborough, John Norton Loughborough. We have a J.N. Andrews and a J.N. Loughborough, so it's a little bit, sometimes you don't watch it, you can slip on these. Both of them are Johns, but the middle names are different. J.N. Loughborough, you will find him in Volume 6, Number 4 of Lest We Forget. The lead article is entitled Faithful Eyewitness, and the article that deals with his timeline is entitled J.N. Loughborough, How a Dream Changed His Life. The timeline and things are there in the issue, as well as a lot more information, more than what we'll be able to touch on our brief overview today. His picture is here, the last in the collection of the ones that we have here today. Don't know exactly his age at that time, but a kindly face, I would say. 1832, January 26, he was born. Victor, New York. Victor is southwest of Rochester, so a lot of these people are coming from the same place there in at least either origins or a lot of their lives were spent in that part of New York. A lot of work there in central New York. Age 7, 1839, his father, a local Methodist Episcopal preacher, dies of typhoid fever. So again, these typhoid fevers were deadly often. Age of 7, he becomes fatherless. And he then, at some point, between then and 4 years later, 1843, when he was 11, he went to live with his godly grandfather. So this sort of repeats another story we heard, a boy growing up with a grandfather. But this one is not a tavern keeper. This one's also a Methodist Episcopal preacher. And this grandfather always had morning and evening worship. You know, the Lord knows where we come from. And he knows where George Amidon came from. And he knows where John Loughborough came from. And he understands perhaps the influences of some of these early things. Even though Amidon, as we read earlier, didn't partake of the alcohol, he did not have this godly influence of a praying grandfather, morning and evening worship. You have to understand it. The Lord understands all of that. And John Loughborough often heard his grandfather praying for him. How does that affect a young person? We can't really fully imagine. The family responded, Loughborough family responded to the Advent message being preached by James Berry, and the family was disfellowshipped because of their Advent belief from the Methodist Episcopal Church. The next year, Loughborough's 12 years of age, 1844, and the disappointment occurs. He recounts that he was out chopping wood, which tells you the Advent believers were not all just leaving their earthly pursuits and looking for, you know, the coming of Christ. Because why would you be chopping wood in October in New England? If you're getting ready for winter. Why would you be getting ready for winter if Christ is coming? Because you're going to leave this earth, you know? So anyway, I've tried to put that together in my mind after I read the story and pondered the implications of what that meant. But anyway, we know God's people are at different levels of understanding and commitment, even. 1847, 3 years later, age 15, he was apprenticed in the carriage-making business with his brother for 7 months, short-term apprenticeship. The next year, age 16, May of 1848, he becomes converted. By that I mean he actually gives his life to Christ. He decides, the world, I'm not going to live for the world. He's old enough to make that decision now. And he works as an apprentice in a blacksmith shop to learn carriage ironing. That means putting ironwork on carriages and such. While he's studying the scriptures the rest of the time. So he's converted. He's got a job learning how to work. And he's spending his free time studying the scriptures. Age 16. Same year. I'm sorry. Next year. But before his birthday. He's still 16. 1849. January the 2nd, he begins preaching. This is his first discourse. 16 years of age, he's starting to preach. He's an Adventist, right? Believer in the Advent. He's preaching the message about about Christ's coming after the disappointment. His first discourse, the record is, it was to a full house. The second discourse, this was in a church. Second discourse, the preacher got up at the end and said, this is the last of the meetings. We're going to have a singing school that's starting tomorrow night here. And somebody else jumped up, realizing what was happening, and he said, these meetings will continue in a schoolhouse. Because obviously the minister decided he wanted no more of this Advent message. And he invented an excuse, which was, we're going to start a singing school. And the crowd moved with him to the schoolhouse. And he had a total of seven lectures, apparently, there in that series. Again, he seemed to be effective, even at that young age, of holding people and explaining things. He also painted houses during these early years and sold patent sash locks, something that back then that they obviously needed for their sashes, to support himself. And he preached on Sundays whenever the openings occurred. So you can see it's a part-time preacher. Whenever there's an invitation, he went and supported himself by these ventures. 2 years later, calendar years, 1851, he's 19 years old, he marries Mary Walker. The next year, age 20, some of his church members that he's been working with become interested in the sanctuary question. Now, in the light of the history, why would some believers who obviously he's teaching the Advent message to become interested in the sanctuary? This is 8 years after the passing of time. It's clear that they get wind. They come to understand the history of the Advent movement, which has been going on for some years now, and they learn about the disappointment, and they start to learn that some people explain the disappointment based on this sanctuary message. And not only that, this is 3 years after James White has started publishing periodicals on present truth, which explains this and gets it out there, right? Not just one article by Crozier in Daystar or Daydawn, right? Here's a series of periodicals coming out. So you can see why this is filtering out there. And so some of his own members are interested in that, and it interests him. But when some of them begin keeping the Sabbath, Seventh-day Sabbath, which obviously went along with the sanctuary, right? Many ways, he becomes concerned because he thinks that is not biblical.
That means
at
that point he was not keeping the Sabbath.
Oh no, he's a first day Adventist. He hasn't even encountered the Sabbath at this point. We tend to think of these people as always Seventh day Adventists, but he was Methodist Episcopal, who accepted the message of the second coming of Christ. It was disfellowship from the Methodist Church, but kept their Adventist beliefs, obviously still Christian, becomes converted, decides to preach the message. What is he preaching? He's preaching the message of the Advent, the message he knows about the coming of Christ as best he can. I don't know what he was saying about the disappointment at the time. I don't know how he was explaining it or saying when Christ was coming. That may be recorded as well. I don't recall the details of it. I did read them. Yes. But watch what happens here. He becomes convinced that he must answer these confused people. And he starts accumulating his Bible text on this. Okay? But before he has an opportunity to do this, he has a dream. And if you read the history of his life, Loughborough was a dreamer. Not a dreamer in the sense of a man who thought of new things to do, or a dreamer that he sat around daydreaming. He had dreams that gave him premonitions and instructions and things like that. So it's clear that sometimes God communicates with certain people that way. And it's interesting why he does with some and not others. But it happened over and over again with this man. And he had a dream of seeing, in this amazing description, I didn't have much room to put many details here. He described it in detail. A dark room that was just dingy and not even, you wouldn't want him to be there. And that's where his group was meeting and talking. But then he saw an open door, and there's this bright room just full of light. People in there were happy, and I think he actually saw some of his members in there. And he saw in there a man with a chart explaining the sanctuary. And as the events unfolded, he has this information about the Sabbath and concern about it. He has this dream. September 25 and 26, the Sabbath-keeping meetings were scheduled for Rochester. And he heard about it, and he figured that's where I can meet my members that are getting caught up in this, and this is where I can meet this preacher and show him the Bible text that shows that he's wrong. So here's his description that he gives, and it's in his collection called Miracles in My Life. It's published in 1987 because actually it's a compilation of articles that he wrote that was done by Leah Schmidtke here in Mentone. That's why I had a later date on it, because it was not really published as such in such form in his lifetime, but it was printed and published as a periodical article, so we still put it under his collection. He describes it, as we went into the room, they were in the midst. Now, he actually went into this bright room in reality, not in his dream. As we went into the room, they were in the midst of a testimony meeting. There were no fanatical, boisterous demonstrations, but calm, sensible testimonies, wet down with tears. That's often a sign that the Spirit is moving people. Such a heavenly atmosphere greatly impressed me. Then in stepped Harvey Cottrell from Millgrove. Now, if you want to review the Cottrell outline, you'll find Harvey Cottrell was mentioned in the Cottrell outline in conjunction with Loughborough. So there's a connection. You might want to go back and do that. From Millgrove, he said, in he stepped, face beaming with the love of God. Your faces reveal something. Praise the Lord for his goodness to me. He's quoting now Cottrell. I came here last Thursday, anxious to attend the meetings, but spent the whole time in bed with fever. At my request, the brethren followed the rule in James, anointing me with oil and prayed for me, and I am healed. Praise the Lord. With this quiet, simple statement, the Spirit of the Lord filled the room. I said to myself, that is just as it was in my uncle's case. My prejudice was fast yielding to the conviction that these people had the blessing of the Lord with them. As I looked about the room, I noticed there hung directly in front of me the identical chart I had seen in my dream. And as Elder J.N. Andrews arose to speak, I recognized him too. He began, "The time announced for the preaching service has come. I had prepared to speak on a certain subject, but during the social meeting..." Now, what's the social meeting? Right, that's what they call the testimony. He earlier called it a testimony meeting, but many times it's called it a social meeting. So anytime you see that in the early descriptions of these meetings, Ellen White talked about it in the years around Minneapolis. Social meeting. Pardon? Testimony meeting. They're telling their own experiences and how the Lord's working in their life and their conviction that they've come under. That's social meeting. And actually, she says that's when people should do talking among each other. Anyway, that's another topic. But she says after church, they should go quietly to their homes. Social meeting is the time for this other sharing thing. But anyway, it's interesting to see how they use these words. But during the social meeting, Jane Andrews is saying, my mind turned to another topic, another subject. It may be the Lord's will for me to speak on the texts which are supposed to teach that the Ten Commandments were abolished at the cross. Elder Andrews did not know who I was. No one had said a word to him since I came in. Beginning with the Colossians, he took my text one by one in the exact order in which I had marked them and straightened them all out to my perfect satisfaction. In examining Colossians, he explained that there are two laws. The moral law of the Ten Commandments is eternal. Whereas the law of ceremonies pointed to Christ and ceased at the cross, a solemn impression of the Spirit of God came with his presentation. I said to myself, this is the most consistent of anything I have ever heard on the law question. It will settle the whole thing for me, and it did. In later presentations, Elder Andrews covered the subjects of the two-horned beast, the sanctuary and its cleansing, and the three angels' messages. He took pains to make every point clear. Almost daily, he visited and prayed with us. So it's not just upfront preaching, teaching. It's one-on-one, you know, visiting and praying, processing. Very important, very important. A true pastor does that. He doesn't know what really to preach about unless he does that. Unless the Holy Spirit's giving him dreams or whatever, and impressions. Because he finds out in the visiting with the people what the needs really are too. The Rochester Company did much praying also for the interested ones. It was not simply the bare argument in favor of the truth that so deeply moved us, as the evident presence of the Spirit which accompanied the presentation of those truths and broke the fallow ground in our hearts. I could not keep away from the meetings, nor resist the powerful arguments presented. Miracles of My Life, page 19. It does something to you to read these stories, does it not? Sure thing. Yes, this book is on the CD-ROM. These are the references from the CD-ROM that I have here at the end of the paragraphs. 4 years later, 1856, he's 24 years old. He becomes discouraged regarding how to support himself. Obviously, he continued preaching, but now the full message. And he ends up in Waukon, Iowa, of all places, with Jane Andrews and the others. And as we said before, talking about Andrews, James and Ellen White show up in the middle of winter. And the story is fascinating to read. But Ellen White says to him, specifically, and to Loughborough, "What doest thou here, Elijah?" And he tells her what he's doing there, wondering why she's saying Elijah. And she repeats it with a different emphasis. First time she emphasized, I think, doest, and then she emphasized here, and then she says it a third time, and she says what? She emphasizes what, you know? In the original, you can see the italics on the word that she emphasized. And he begins to be humbled in the dust, that he's like Elijah, who's running from the Lord, you know? And he's called back to preach. 1858, age of 26, we're 2 years later now. His daughter Teresa is born, but she dies 2 years later. 1864, age of 32, his son Delmer is born. 3 years later, 1867, June 24th, at the age of 35, Mary, his wife, dies after childbirth with twins, and one of the twins does not survive. The one that does survive, they name Mary after her. 1868, age of 36, he had dreams. And if you read his story, these were multiple dreams. He had dreams of being in California. Dreams of being in California. And he felt impressed that he should go to the General Conference that year, ready to go to California. And another man by the name of Bordeaux and his wife came there with the same impression. At least the impression to sell everything and be ready to go where God wants them to go. It's a fascinating story because as the meetings went forward, the needs of California arose because they were getting reports of people, believers, Adventists. By the way, this is 1868. This is almost 20 years after the gold rush. The big movement to California is drawing even Adventists, right? And the lay people that went out there are sharing their faith. And they're saying, send someone out here. There's interest here, you know? And James White, if you read the story of the GC session, does anybody have a burden to go to California? And they share. Loughborough says, I've had these dreams. And Bordeaux said, we've been impressed to be prepared to go where somewhere the Lord wants. And so what do they say? They say, would you pray about it. And we will pray about it. And they enter into prayer over days to see if this impression is really from the Lord. They don't just jump at it. And it's amazing to read how they went through that process and finally were convicted. This is of the Lord. And so, that year, he is sent with Bordeaux and his wife to California. And from Battle Creek, they head east. Now, do I seem to be confused geographically? Why would you go east to California from Battle Creek? There's only two ways to California in those days. One is 3 months by ox cart. And if you take off from Battle Creek, you don't go east, you go west, right? The other way to California is by boat most of the way. And the closest boat for California is not west, but east. And so they take the train to New York. And they buy a tent in New York, and Loughborough gets a wife in New York. He marries Maggie Newman. And I'm not never have figured out how he found how he got these wives, but anyway, they marry there, and Bordeaux marries them. Get on the boat, and they head south down the coast through the Caribbean to the Isthmus of Panama. And they get off the boat, get on a train. Canal's not there yet. Get on a train, go across the Isthmus. Get off the train, get on another boat, and take it up the west coast, Pacific Ocean, to San Francisco. And somehow, maybe by Pony Express, I figure, news of their arrival precedes them. There's a newspaper that has come from New York, because when they left New York, the New York papers felt it newsworthy to write an article. Two preachers going to California with a tent. And when that story is read in California, in the Bay Area, there's a man who has a dream of two preachers coming to San Francisco and starting fires. And other preachers trying to put out the fires, and the more they tried to put them out, the more they spread. And I think the dream was actually before the newspaper article was read. And when the newspaper came, he went down to San Francisco to find these men. And when he got there, it was the very day they had arrived, and he met the man who had taken them from the boat to the house they were going to stay in. Talk about providences. And so the very day Loughborough gets there, somebody knocking at the door saying, "I've had dreams about your coming. Come to Petaluma and preach the message." Anyway, fascinating story. I had more details than we have time to have on this paper and tell all about it. But 1868, the message comes to California by official workers, okay? Bordeaux. 1872, 4 years later, after evangelistic meeting after evangelistic meeting, usually going north there, Petaluma, Windsor, Healdsburg, Santa Rosa, that area up through there. It was right where 101 goes now, north out of San Francisco. All those towns you go right through. Miracles occurring, too. There was an interruption of the meetings. There was a smallpox epidemic. And because some of them were medically trained, they stopped the meetings and just started ministering to people. Okay? Medical missionary work in those early years. 4 years later, actually 1 year after they get here, 1869, the railroad connects. Promontory Junction, Utah. They drive in the Gold Spike. And all of a sudden, what took 3 months by ox cart or 1 month by boat now takes 1 week by train. Boy, the place opens up, right? And within a few years, guess who arrives? While they're living in Santa Rosa, Loughborough and his wife, James and Ellen White, come and visit them. Their first trip to California, obviously not their last, as we studied their lives. 1875, age of 43, his second wife, Maggie, dies from tuberculosis, March 24. She had cared for a patient who had TB in her home, and she contracted it. Later that year, John marries Anna M. Driscoll, who was Secretary Treasurer of the Pacific Press. Move on to 1878. At the age of 46, he and his wife are called to work in England. They plan to go on a certain ship. You can read the details of this story. Names of the ships and everything are given. And the captain denied them passage. Captain always has final word, what goes on his ship and what happens. And I don't understand fully why he denied them passage. He denied them passage, so they had to find another boat to go on. The boat that they were denied passage on was lost at sea, never heard of again. And so they safely got to England, and that was the year, too, that he first gets word from Ellen White that he needs to give his faithful witness of God's leading in the past history of the movement. So this is 1878. It's only 34 years after the passing of the time. Only how many years after he accepted the message? 26 years. Okay, but he's been in the message longer than he was old when he accepted it. So more than half of his life has been in the message. And he's already being told, you must give a faithful witness of God's leading the past history. And here's how he describes it. We have it in our book, The Great Second Advent Movement. As I recall, this is in the Appendix A that was added to his 1905 edition. We did put 1905 on the book, but it's actually the 1992 edition, which has some additional material that was never published until we did this. His 1918 document, which is where he tells his history. At that time, he says, I received these words in a testimony from Sister White. You have an experience valuable to the cause of God. It must be made to tell for its full value. One thing I failed to say in those early years, after he accepted the message, not only did he end up in Waukon, Iowa, but he traveled extensively with James and Ellen White. In holding meetings, he saw Ellen White in having vision multiple times, 40 or 50 times he saw her in vision. And he saw what he felt was incontrovertible evidence that, number one, this is supernatural, and it is, and number two, it's of God. And so, even though, you know, he's had his problems and he's had times of discouragement, as we've looked at, she's saying, you have an experience valuable to the cause of God. It must be made to tell for its full value. I suppose that to mean that in my labors, I should show what I had seen and known in connection with my labors of the Lord's dealings and special leading in the work. At that time, I had not thought that it meant that I should write out such experiences for publication, but that I should speak of these things in connection with my public labors. Many times, as I would pray, have I said, Lord, what is meant by its full value? And when I would ask some of our ministers, what is meant by that expression, its full value? All the answer I could get was, it means just what it says, but gave me no further light as to its full import. So I went on in my preaching, trying to show that the Lord was truly leading in this Advent movement, and had by direct instruction through the gift of prophecy, as I had witnessed often, directed in this work those who would humbly accept his teaching. Again, page 484, Great Second Advent Movement, the 92 edition. 3 years later, 1881, he returns to the USA for the General Conference session, and then he goes back to England to train his own son and daughter. Okay? What are their names? His own son and daughter? Delmer and Mary. He trains his own son and daughter to work there when he and his wife were going to return to the U.S. for good. 1890, age 58, Ellen White called him to stand firmly for the testimonies. And the context for this is interesting, very, very interesting and very essential to understand. Because of what Ellen White did at Minneapolis in the years later, people who had long had confidence in her ministry began to question it. The most prominent one being Uriah Smith. Interestingly enough, she never hints that Loughborough ever did. And also interestingly enough, there's not much evidence as to what Loughborough did in response to Minneapolis. Because when he gives his account that he wrote in 1905 of Adventist history, It's not on the radar screen. It's not on his radar. Whereas Ellen White wrote over and over and over and over again about the incident in Minneapolis and the importance of the meeting and the amazing tug of war that occurred there. She said most incomprehensible tug of war she'd ever experienced. And then the years of battle, resistance that they had to work against. And it was the resistance against the message and her endorsement of the message that caused unbelief to come in of the testimonies. So she's looking around and thinking, who is really a firm believer in the testimonies? Brother Loughborough is. He's been with me from those early years. He's not been shaken by this. Again, she never says that I found that he's running with it, the message of Minneapolis. But at least he's not being shaken by the unbelief building afterwards. And so he says at that point, he begins to write Rise and Progress of the Third Angel's Message. And Ellen White put it this way. This Loughborough references in his Great Second Advent Movement, page 485. Again, this is the 1992 edition. But this is also found in Ellen White's writings because this is something she wrote. And you can find this in the 1888 materials, pages 714 to 719, the entire letter. She's describing the need, what the church needs right now. And this is the important part of it that Loughborough's referenced in. I say, let Elder Loughborough do a work that is suffering to be done in the churches. The Lord would have his voice heard, as was John's, telling the things which he himself has experienced in the rise and progress of the third angel's message. Do you see why he called his book that? Rise and Progress of the Third Angel's Message? Do you see why she's referencing John? Do you remember what John said in the beginning of his first epistle? The things which we have seen from the beginning, which we have heard, which our hands have handled of the Word, these we declare to you. You know, this is John. Read those first verses there in his first epistle. Amazing. He says, John says, I'm speaking to you as someone who was there. I saw Jesus. I touched him. I knew him. And she's saying, this other John, this other John needs to do a similar work. Let Elder Loughborough stand in his right place as a Caleb coming to the front and bearing decided testimony in face of unbelief and doubt and skepticism. We be well able to go up and possess the goodly land. Another Bible illustration, parallel. 10 spies, unbelief. We're like grasshoppers. We can't go in there. Caleb comes to the forefront and says, be quiet. We are well able to go up. Man of faith. Caleb and Joshua, both of these men. Elder Loughborough has a work to do like Caleb. Again, do not fasten Elder Loughborough in a corner anywhere. Do not bind him down to any one conference. Let him go here and there and everywhere, telling what he has seen and known and handled in the rise of the third angel's message. You see this unique calling that this man had at a particularly critical time, and the need was not going to end in the 1890s. It was going to build. And I think this is one of the reasons why the Lord prolonged this man's life beyond the lifespan of any of the pioneers. It was because of the value. He knew that even though in his story of 1888 era, it wasn't anything there, his story of 1844 was rock solid. That God was in the message from the beginning, and we must not leave it, even though this unbelief is shaking the very foundations of the movement. And prominent leaders are going out and denying the sanctuary message and taking hospitals away from the denomination. All of this was going on during these years that were coming up. And so in 2 years' time, 1892, he's 60 years old, The Rise and Progress of the Third Angel's Message is published, and he tells how he used it. Now he had a book, not just his own words that he was telling people. He would go around and tell the story and say, here's my book. I'm telling how it happened. The question was he a delegate at the 1888 conference or attending there? I don't recall for sure one way or the other, to be honest with you. I didn't have a chance to check it out. It's a good question, because it is documented there. Do you want me to look at the... I can easily pull up the list of delegates to see if he was there.
He didn't write about it then?
No. That's puzzled me. I've never found any evidence that he did. No evidence that he ever addressed the significance of that history. And again, that's why if you look at the book that we published in 92, republished the edition of his Great Second Advent Movement, there's an appendix in the back. Because after I went through the book, in the preface, the new preface, I give the reasons why the book is important. In the end of the book, where it's talking about the missing parts of the history, I basically try to explain why I felt the book was important. It was not for the critical understanding of why there was a delay coming, because he doesn't deal with that. He pictures it growing and growing and growing. Everything's good. He talks about the sand burning. He never mentions why the sand burned. Okay? So he doesn't have a handle on Minneapolis and its fallout. But his experience from those early days is so solid. She's saying, retell what happened at the beginning. At least people won't give up on the movement as a whole. And this is sort of the way I saw it. And I think I explained it this way. In that appendix, I think it's appendix C in the reprint. She's saying, in essence, the Lord's been building a house. He's given a message that will finish the house. People have rejected that message, so the house can't be finished. But not only can't not be finished, when the message to finish it was rejected, there's such confusion. They're starting to tear up the foundations, and she's saying, "Wait now, don't tear up the foundations. Leave the foundations." Another generation will come and build on the foundations and finish it. And so who does she turn to reaffirm the foundations? Those people that were still alive there in the early years. None of which accepted the message that would finish the house in its fullness. I found no evidence for that. But she called on them, and some of them were actually the ones that were opposing the message in 1888. She called them to give their testimony from the early years. So, damage control was what she went into. And the people that she turned to for damage control were some of the ones that were responsible for the damage. Undo what you've caused. Limit the damage that you've caused, in that sense. But let's look briefly here, if you want to take a second, to answer that significant question. And that is, was Loughborough a delegate in 1888? Say the question again. The question is, Uriah Smith ever accept the 1888 message? And I have found no evidence for it. There is, we haven't covered his life yet, and so we'll touch on that a little bit more. But there was a period of confession, and many people looked to that to say his opposition stopped. But if you look more carefully, she's writing to him after that. The position you took at the beginning has been a continual snare to you. And she says to him, the messengers, Jones and Wagner, are presenting the message to the Church of Laodicea. Woe be to anyone that does not take this message. And she says to him, I hope that you succeed with the third angel's message. And unfortunately, the evidence is such, and we will specifically mention this when we come to his life, that the year before he dies, he publishes in the Review a series of articles that present the anti-Minneapolis view of Galatians. And they remove him from editorship over that, and he never recovers from it. Talking about Smith. Her question was about Uriah Smith and whether he ever accepted the message that came at Minneapolis. And I would say in its fullness, because nothing's all or nothing. You know, we need to speak. Right, that's right. So General Conference bulletins from 88. Let me just look at them quickly and see if Loughborough's name shows up. Okay. No, he was not present. At the 1888 conference, the record is that an interesting report was received from Elder Loughborough of California. S. N. Haskell devoted a few moments to the question. And so he was not present giving it. So his name only shows up one time in the bulletin. He would have been listed under the delegates had he been a delegate or been present otherwise. So he was not present. So who knows what would have happened had he been a delegate and been there. It may have been a different story.
He might have polarized or he shouldn't have.
Right. The Lord may have kept him away. He may have joined with Uriah Smith and some of the others. You're right. So what happened next? We said the book he wrote, Rise and Progress, was used in his public labors, but when the review burned in 1902, obviously when they published books, sometimes they had to print them multiple times because of the demand, and they saved the plates. By that time, they were using plates, not type. Okay, probably that electroplating thing that we were reading about. But when the review burned, the plates melted. Okay. Can't print anything from melted plates, right? There's no type left on that. So, what did he do? 1903, at the age of 70. When he was 71, Ellen White recommended republication of the record of God's leading in the past in these words. And this is in Councils to Writers and Editors, page 145. And look what Ellen White does. This is before she had said this in 1900, right? I'm sorry, in 1890. This is now 13 years later. Have things gotten better? Well, the sand's just burned and the review's just burned. If you think things have gotten better, that should be a big red flag for your idea. And those who think that the message was finally grasped by 1901, perchance, and the church was running with it, have to answer the question, well, then why 1902? And why did she write what she wrote after 1902? And on top of that, why are we here over 100 years later? That's perhaps the biggest question. Tie that with her letter of 1901, we may have to remain in this world many more years because of accepting the 1888 message? No, because of insubordination, which is rebellion against God. Here's what she wrote. 1903. I feel deeply over our present situation. We must now do a work that should have been done long ago. Maybe 1890, maybe even before that. We must do as the Lord directed Moses to do. When the children of Israel, having crossed the desert, were encamped on the borders of Jordan, Moses was bidden to do what? Rehearse to them all the dealings of the Lord to them during their journeys through the wilderness. The record of this rehearsal is what? Found in the book of Deuteronomy. That's what the book is. Second law. Second reading of the law. That's where Moses was told, give it to them plainly. It's the same verb that occurs only one other place out of Deuteronomy is in the book of Habakkuk. Write the vision plainly, that those can run who read it. And so she's getting a message here. Do like Moses did. Recount the history. Write it plainly. And then what does she say? The record of the experiences through which the people of God passed in the early history of our work must be republished. It was statements like this that began our Adventist Pioneer Library project. I didn't understand personally, I don't know how much the others did, the historical context for why she was saying this at that very time. But it has become clear as we understood history better. This is why she's saying that. We just said, she said to do it, let's do it. It hadn't been done electronically. And so we began to do the computerization of the writings and things like that. The record of the experience through which the people of God passed in the early history of our work must be republished. Many of those who have since come into the truth are ignorant of the way in which the Lord had wrought. A whole generation had been born that were not there in the 1840s and 50s. Just like in Moses' experience, how many had been born in the wilderness, right? They hadn't seen the Red Sea, hadn't seen the miracles. The experience of William Miller and his associates, of Captain Joseph Bates, and of the other pioneers in the Advent message should be kept before our people. Elder Loughborough's book should receive attention. If you look at the back of the copy, I was going to bring you a copy of the book and I didn't. On the back of the book, we have that quote. Ellen White's endorsing it. Now, 1903, this was the previous book, which they still had some copies of, even though the plates had melted, right? But now we have the later book. So that's the one that we distribute, because our rule was print the latest book that they did in writing their history. I don't think the earlier book had anything more in it. The later book has more in it. She says, our leading men should see what they can be done for the circulation of this book. I think still this book would be an ideal book to give to newly baptized church members. That's why we had a baptism here at Drayson Center back in 2006. Was it 2006? I think it was, or 2008. We gave a copy of it to everyone that was baptized after the Randy Skeet meetings in San Bernardino. Here's your spiritual family history. Read it and find out who you are, you know, that type of thing. So in 1905, he's 73 years old. He published the Great Second Advent Movement. He is not old in spirit. 3 years later, 1908, he travels around the world at the age of 76, giving a faithful eyewitness to God's past leading. He's going around the world telling his story. Probably, I would think, maybe even distributing the book. Who knows?
The book is also being
mentioned. Oh, yes. We need to mention that not only has it been republished, it is being narrated, and it will be available as an audiobook. In fact, there are several chapters already available online. Go to adventaudio.org and look under Loughborough, and you'll see what has been narrated already of this book. Soon, all the chapters will be there. And adventaudio.org. Adventaudio.org. And it's under Loughborough, obviously. You'll see it easily there. And you can listen to this book. Pardon? Oh, you want to give me a sample?
You know the book?
Joseph.
That's good. So, yeah. There are other works on that website that you'll want to be blessed by as well. Yeah. And he reads it with a passion because of his conviction about it, which is really very, very helpful. Loughborough continued to be active. His latter years was spent in St. Helena. In the teens, which I didn't cover here at all, in the teens, there were people that began to attack his history, saying, you have deceived the people. And he wrote a defense of his history. After 1908, the 19 teens, right.
11, 19,
exactly,
12.
Right. 1918, I believe, was the date on the manuscript that we found. We read about it, and then we found there was a copy, and we actually computerized it. And the original copy, he typed on an old teletype typewriter, which the telegraphs were used with. Every letter was capital, you know. It's interesting to read that. He typed this thing out. I don't know whether he did it himself. He probably did. But we had that original copy. We have a retyped copy, and it had never been edited or published. And it would have been, his copy of it was given to a teacher at Angwin before he died. And that professor's house burned with his entire library. But he had taken that manuscript, and it was on his desk at the college when his house burned. And that professor gave it to Leroy Froom, when Froom was going around collecting things for what he called the Advent Resource Collection, I think it was, or Adventist Source Collection. And the professor said, now I know why this was saved. Put it in your collection. Well, it has still not been published. And so we felt we need to give Loughborough a final word. And so we computerized that, and it's Appendix A in this 1992 edition of the Great Second Advent Movement. And he gives a defense of his history. He tells a lot about his own personal life story, autobiographical information. And so that's the major addition to the 1905 book that we added there. There's actually three appendices that we added, and that's the first one, the big one. And so he had words clear into his 80s, defending the history and recounting it. Actually, did anyone ever know Mrs. Evelyn Moran that lived here in Loma Linda? You knew her? Her husband, I believe, was a Bible teacher for years here. I don't think I ever met him, but she was a friend of my parents because her daughter was married to a pastor where my parents were living in North Carolina. And so I got to know her here during her later years. In fact, she ended up becoming a neighbor of mine after she got rid of her house on Prospect and Hillcrest. She had the house right on the corner there. My parents lived down the street from her when they were here in the 40s. I think she was there in the 40s too. And they never got to meet her in those years. But later years, they became good friends with her. She moved into a condominium right next to us there in Grand Terrace when we lived up there. And in visiting her one time, she said, as a young girl, I worked at St. Helena Sanitarium, and I took care of Brother Loughborough. I remember Brother Loughborough. She was old enough that she was working before 1924, because it was in April the 7th of 1924 that at the age of 92, Brother Loughborough died. And you will find his grave without too much problem if you go to the St. Helena's cemetery. It's over against the west side of the valley there. Drive a little bit out of town, turn into this beautiful cemetery. And you go way on out to the south end of it, over on the right-hand side. Not too far inside there, you'll see his tombstone there. Interestingly enough, I have another friend who was the first boss I ever had. First year in academy, I was working in a pharmacy. He was a pharmacist. He came to live with out near his daughter in the last years of his life, and he recently died, and he was buried just across from Loughborough. And his wife thinks that's wonderful, because when her husband is raised, he'll be able to see Loughborough there. And you can visit his grave. Anyway, what an amazing eyewitness. That's why we called it Faithful Eyewitness, because Lord Ellen White says, tell what you've seen. And we believe he did. Again, these pioneers are not without their faults. None of us have all of what God needs to finish the work. But that's why we need each other, right? And we can thank God that he was faithful, that he never gave up his confidence in the past. I mean, he had so much evidence. He had much more evidence than most people get. And it would have been an amazing thing for him to give up all that evidence. But he was faithful in keeping it and also in recounting it in an amazing way that has been a blessing to many through the years and continues to be a blessing. And this, Colinda has this large notebook on him, younger picture of him here as well, of a younger Loughborough. And if you want to, afterwards you can come up and look at this big notebook with the items that she has in there as well. Let's thank God for John Norton Loughborough.